Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When ecologist Carl Safina steps out the door of his little beach house on Lazy Point on the far end of Long Island, he sees the whole natural world and humans all over it. He's spent a year traveling that world with kayak and fishing pole and scuba gear, and he's come back to tell us what he's seen and to burrow into our philosophy of life and maybe change it. This hour on Point, ecologist, ocean advocate, and natural philosopher, Carl Safina, on the future of the planet and our place in it. You can join the conversation. Do you see our human dignity tied up with nature's? Are we ready to rethink to survive? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Carl Safina, marine ecologist and prominent conservationist, founder and president of the Blue Ocean Institute, which studies the ocean and human impact on it, winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant for his writing and research. His latest book, documenting a year-long journey spanning the globe, is The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Former Audubon editor Gary Soucy calls it the 21st century's Walden. Carl Safina, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. It's really great to be with you.
Wow, was I jealous of your year. You were all over in some quite wonderful places. You've got big, tough challenges to us in here for the way we live and the way we think. But tell us where you were and the pleasures of that journey, Carl.
Well, the year is set on a little piece of land called Lazy Point on the eastern end of Long Island. And from there, I launch off on global journeys that go to the high Arctic, to Antarctica, and across about half of the tropical oceans and seas of the world. So it was a very close to home and very personal book, and also a very global book.
You're not afraid, whatever the status of the planet may be right now, you're not afraid or can't resist enjoying it.
Well, I think that that's entirely the point. One of the reasons that I set the book at the house is that these wanderings of all these animals, the comings and goings of all the birds, all the fish, the migrational energies, the whales, the sea turtles, all of these things really, you know, populate my world, and they're all around everyone. I happen to be fortunate enough to be tuned into seeing them. And I really wanted to share that with everybody because I'm trying to sound an alarm in a way, but not be an alarmist. And I don't want to frighten anybody. I want to tangle people up with how I love the world.
We want to get a sense of both of those. Your thinking about our thinking is as potent here as your marvelous descriptions of the world. You quote E.B. White right at the beginning of the book. I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. That makes it hard to plan the day.
that pretty much describes it, yeah.
That does. Help us get next to you and your good fortune in being right out there where nature is living strong, even as we speak right now. You've got a bit from up in the Arctic where we'll set the stage for us and then give us a little reading. Not so little, but it's really wonderful about you right in the midst of polar bear country.
Okay, great. Well, you know, as I say, the book is mainly set on the east end of Long Island, but we take these immense journeys. And one of the most distant places was up to a place called Svalbard, a set of islands about 800 miles north of Norway in the very high Arctic, where the summer day lasts for 4 months without the sun setting. So we're up there having a look around one end of the planet, and here we go. Behind its cloudy veil, the sun never grazes the horizon, never alludes to night. Only a smudge of dusk marks the days. In the Arctic summer, one feels a little need of sleep, so we sleep briefly. Before sleeping, we rounded Sorkop, the southern cape of Spitsbergen. We're south of the island of Ejoya in the Barents Sea, headed basically north. It's a different realm, an ocean two-thirds ice. The rhythmic rocking and whoosh of water is replaced by the thud and grind of ice along the hull. The normal pattern of bright sky and dark water is inverted, Under a pewter sky, we travel a sea bright with the reflective dazzle of broken pack ice stretching miles and miles. Even here, in the harshness of Dante's ninth circle of hell, life abounds. A halo of kittiwakes and fulmars continue to seek some harvest from the furrow of our churning propellers. Guillemots, like ducks in tuxes, paddle between ice plates. An immaculate ivory gull comes floating into view, briefly ghosting by, and then is gone. One lone walrus, a large male weighing perhaps 3,000 pounds, is napping on a berg. His size and his astounding white daggers afford him peaceful sleep in the realm of the ice bear. On distant ice, a crimson stain. I raise my binoculars. Like binary stars gripped in each other's gravity, two massive polar bears burning white hot in the vast freeze attend their kill. One engorged bear continues pulling listlessly at the well-worked rack of bloody bones and bits. The other has just plopped down in satiated stupor a few paces away. His face looks dipped in crimson paint. 300 yards away, a third bear, much smaller, much whiter, rests on a blocky floe. It may also have smelled the kill from afar and come for scraps, waiting for the bigger and more dangerous bears to take their fill and, I'm sure, to leave. The bear that has been pulling at the carcass decides to slip into the water and begins paddling away like an enormous white beaver. A small galaxy of orbiting ivory and glaucous gulls waste not a moment squabbling onto the smear and frame that was a seal. About 200,000 years ago off Siberia or Alaska, advancing ice sheets forced brown bears to venture far onto sea ice. They found ringed seals and no competition. Killing ringed seals on a frozen ocean was an extreme new niche, and here is the resulting extreme new bear, Ursus maritimus, the sea bear in its true realm. A polar bear is designed for two constants, hunting and heating. Its translucent white camouflage is merely the most obvious adaptation. Beneath their shaggy, hollow guard hairs, polar bears are insulated by dense underwool. Under that fur, beneath their black skin, lies thick blubber. For pulling seals from ice holes, for swimming and for stalking prey where there is nowhere to hide, the whole bear is elongated. Long neck, flattened head. The big shoulder hump of other bears, gone. Their canine teeth are long, stabbing daggers, and their molars are sharpened for a diet that's almost 100% meat. Polar bears' claws are sharply curved ice and seal hooks. Their large, hairy, soled feet afford non-skid ice walking. The ice moves, the seal moves, and the bears wander with them.
Carl Safina reading from his book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. And I hope you get from that a sense of just how close and intimate and marvelous the natural descriptions are here. Carl, I mean, it's lyrical, beautiful writing, but it also goes to philosophy and it goes to a conservationist view of the planet. You write movingly about how wondrous and beautiful what you're seeing is, but you also write, but this story is also partly about a kind of heartbreak for a world that remains so vitally unaware of how imperiled it is. Remains? I mean, we feel like we've been hearing this for decades now, how things are imperiled. Remains?
But we haven't really changed our way of doing business, and although many people have heard about it, it hasn't really sunk in. And I think that that's because the way that we do business, our economic system, the way that we feel about our ethics and morals that our religions give us, our philosophical relationship with the rest of the world, we get these from institutions that are centuries or even thousands of years old. Even capitalism was fully developed with banks and stock markets by the 13th century. And this is before anyone realized the world was round, before anyone knew that the world ever changes, and way before it ever occurred to anybody that something people do can change the world.
This is where I get into new territory with you, and it's welcome, fascinating territory. You're talking about needing to get in, not just to clean up beaches and stop burning fossil fuels. Okay, yes. But you're suggesting that if we don't get into sort of our own software and how we look out at the world, we won't step up to the challenge.
No, because we don't understand the difference between the price of things, the value of things, and the cost of things. For instance, coal. you know, coal is a dirty fossil fuel that is changing the atmosphere. And yet everybody says, well, we have to use a lot of coal because it's so cheap compared to other fuels. Well, it's cheap because there's a lot of it and because the economic system simply prices what you get in the trade. You buy a ton of coal, you get a ton of coal, and that's what you pay for. But the actual cost of the coal is dumped out onto the commons and the future of humanity. The cost includes changing the heat balance of the whole planet, turning the oceans acid, which is dissolving shellfish and dissolving coral reefs. It puts the mercury in our seafood. That's where the mercury comes from. These are all the true costs of coal, but they're nowhere in the price. If the economy really caught up to reality and our understanding of science from the last century and a half, the price of coal would not be cheap. It would be prohibitive because the costs are enormous.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kayaker there off of Long Island. That's Carl Safina territory. Marine ecologist and sometime philosopher is with us today. He's been writing about his travels in the natural world and the fate of the planet, about the link between human dignity and nature. His new book is A View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Carl, you write movingly about the weight of humans on this planet. You put it in ways that sort of drive it home. We hear about it again and again, but you're stepping way back to look at kind of a cosmic scale at the footprint, much more than a footprint, of one species on the whole planet. I wish you'd share some of that with us.
You know, one of the things that really occurred to me and why I think there is so much at stake is that it's not just our footprint here and now, but it's the mark that we make across time and what we're doing for the options of people who will come a generation or 50 generations down the line.
Yes, that grows out of what's happening right now. You're talking about the Homo sapiens, what, taking roughly 40% of the life that the whole planet produces now to feed one species out of all the species.
That's a really incredible thing, is that of all of the plant mass that grows every year, humans either eat or we feed to animals that we then eat. 40% of everything that is produced on land and in the coastal seas. That's just a staggering proportion for one mid-sized species.
And you're talking
about... we really dominate. I think, you know, we've achieved the first goal of dominating the Earth, and maybe it's time to reevaluate our goals.
You say, in accounting terms, we're running a deficit, eating into our principal, liquidating our natural capital assets. Something's getting ready to break. At that scale of this species, our species in position on the planet, you say... It's really matched only by geological and cosmic scale forces.
Yeah, in the past, things that would cause mass extinctions were things like strikes by an asteroid. We're causing a mass extinction right now that is about at the scale of the one that snuffed out the dinosaurs. Also, the only things that in the past would really change the atmosphere were things like volcanic forces. And we are changing the atmosphere quite rapidly now. There's about a third more carbon dioxide in the composition of the air than there was at the start of the Industrial Revolution in 1800. That's a really, really major force.
You're off to the Arctic, the Antarctic, to the Pacific Islands and tropical coral there. And then one night, this is fairly deep in the book, you're out looking at a clear, crisp night with the Milky Way spilled across the sky. This is 3:21 or so, and there's a paragraph where you talk about those future generations, the weight of our species right now, and a sense of justice, morality, even what's sacred and what's sacrilegious.
Yeah. So, yes, it was...
Do you want to read a little bit of that for us?
It was a beautiful, beautiful night, really crisp, clear night, and I'll read it for you here. For us to be straining the cables of our planet's life support systems, despite clear warnings, may constitute mere foolishness. But the unborn who did not choose this path will arrive saddled with all conceivable consequences. The poor likewise did not choose it, nor the other living creatures that, like us, strive to live and raise their young, yet find their world besieged. Justice means to render what is deserved, and because we've created a situation that is not merely unsustainable but unjust, it becomes a moral matter. To have these things revealed and then choose to revert to blindness is, I dare say, sin and sacrilege.
You don't shy away from thinking about the sacred, from thinking of how we even think through religion in building a worldview that's led us to kind of nonchalantly do what we've done. Talk to us about the sacred for a minute and how you might reimagine it.
Well, you know, this planet contains all of the mind, all of the heart, all of the soul, all of the intelligence, all of the compassion that we have detected in the entire universe. And if you imagine looking out across the universe and finding life, that would be enormously, enormously meaningful. Well, we are that meaning. We are the only living thing yet detected, by us anyway, in the universe. And if we can consider anything sacred, we can consider a book sacred or a building sacred, then I think that, you know, this very planet itself, it has to be considered sacred. How can you avoid a conclusion like that? It seems so obvious.
But many religions have held humans in particular and specifically apart from the rest in dominion, of course, we've read, and looked for the soul, spirit, heaven, grace in the world, but also apart from it. You're saying, look to the connectedness. We don't have our own dignity, maybe our own soul without it.
I believe that that's true. It's also true that in those scriptures you can find all of these other bits of wisdom that are so extraordinarily important. Dominion does not necessarily mean harming the world, and there are many, many places in the Bible, in the Quran, where bequeathing a living world to the next generations is required. Both of those holy texts say that in times of war, you may kill other people, but you may not destroy fruit trees. You have your problems with other people, but you have no right to pick a fight or diminish the prospects of the next generation. You do not have that right. These are all things that we've been told, and we are ignoring it.
Carl Safina writes, ethics that focus on human interactions, morals that focus on humanity's relationship to Creator alone, fall short of the things we've learned, of the big take-home message. He says, life is more than anything else a process. It creates and depends on relationships among energy, land, water, air, time, and living things. It's not just about human-to-human interactions. It's not just about spiritual interaction. He writes, it's about all interaction. Let's get our callers in here. Fort Myers, Florida, Deb is on the line. Hi, Deb, you're on the air with Carl Safina.
Hi, Tom and Carl. Tom, at the top of the show, you asked if we thought that our dignity was tied up with nature. Well, I'll tell you what, I think not only our dignity, but our very lives are tied up with nature. And I'm one of a group of people who is doing something about it. I'm a volunteer with the Florida Alliance for Renewable Energy, and during the month of February, across the state of Florida in 10 different cities, we are bringing a tour of events. It can be found on the website www.farenergy.org, and we are pushing for legislation for the Sunshine State to actually become friendly to small distributed and mid-sized distributed renewable energy sources.
Deb, you're on the job there, and we hear it, and Carl, Deb picked right up on the point that you make, human dignity related to the health of the entire planet. She says human life, the life part, we've often heard, and Deb's out there fighting for it. The new angle you're bringing here is that, you know, and I guess it's to disabuse ourselves of the notion that we can somehow have it apart from this, but human dignity itself, tied up with nature's dignity.
Yeah.
Expand on
exactly.
That.
This is, I think, one of the later conclusions that I came to in experiencing all these things and going to all these places and observing and thinking about what I was seeing, is that Nature and human dignity require each other. You think about an extreme example like Haiti. They've had terrible, oppressive governments, no freedom. They utterly destroyed the nature around them because people who are not free and who are oppressed don't have the liberty of taking care of the natural world around them. And with that world destroyed, the prospects for dignity moving forward are gone. It's almost impossible to get back on your feet, to create options, to create a way of not just struggling to survive, but to become humanized. You need nature for that. When I see the coral reefs degrading, as an ecologist, my heart breaks for the coral reefs, but also I see the people losing the fish and the income and the food that supports them, the reefs that protect them against storms. And as people get poorer, their dignity just drains away, and their prospects and their children's prospects also just evaporate.
How do we sustain the part of dignity, or maybe the whole of it, that depends on healthy nature around us when that's draining away? How do humans sustain it? You point to Haiti, but we're all in this together in some way. You describe it. I mean, it's possible for it to bleed away to where we'd not even don't have the dignity to really stand up and fight for what we may be losing.
Right. Well, we have a really disastrous view that that our economy has given us, that we need growth, that we always have to be growing. The problem is that this runs completely into the face of reality. The planet does not grow. And when we grow the economy, it means putting more material through it. On a planet that doesn't grow, you eat through the planet. And if everybody who's going to be here by mid-century wants to live like us, it would require 2.5 planet Earths. That clearly is not possible. So, you know, we have this problem. But the idea of growth is to give everybody more. And everybody could get more if instead of growth, we think of development. Development meaning not to put more material through, but to improve things, to improve education, to improve medicine, to improve peace. And if we were able to stop the growth that we're so caught in and addicted to and stuck in, and rein it back in, then it would ease all of this strain and people would get more. China realized that with a one-child policy, and although I don't like the coercive nature of the way that they've done it, that's one of the reasons that China has escaped its own famines and has given itself the elbow room to come on so strong in developing better lives for its people. And for most poor people, it's not a matter of telling them, oh, you should have smaller families. But the things that are compassionate to people and help them develop also happen to make them not really want huge families. For instance, simply teaching girls to read and write in many developing countries and giving them a little bit of education on how to run a business results in them not wanting to mainly have a large family. Also, the children of illiterate women tend also to be illiterate and have larger families. So by helping them develop, it eases the pressures on them, it eases the pressures on the world around them, and it helps them to have better lives. It's a win all around. But we have to realize that growth is a losing proposition as a goal.
Carla, we should go straight to another reading to keep us plugged into nature as we contemplate what you're saying. You've got a piece in Palau in the Pacific. You've anchored there, and you're going down to the coral reef. Make that alive for us as we think about your bigger view. Write to it if you would.
Sure, sure. Okay. So Palau is in the Western Pacific. It's a tropical island country, and it's just extraordinarily beautiful. And here we go. We go out to the reef, and we anchor in the swells. Our boat driver assesses how the anchor is holding, then stuffs a new wad of betel nut into his cheek and relaxes. We splash in and descend. The water is warm, 82 degrees Fahrenheit. I land almost on top of a sea cucumber that looks like a slow-crawling caterpillar the size of a loaf of French bread. Visibility out here is over 100 feet. The crest we're on slopes to an abrupt vertical wall, plunging to true abyss. The current, insistent, pushy, makes this a tricky spot to dive. One moment you're over reef corals almost close enough to touch, one lick seaward and you're in open ocean, staring into blue-black water thousands of feet deep, silhouetted for any tiger or bull sharks below like a roast pig at a banquet. It's intense. The bewildering array of corals instantly overwhelms, and the thing is, 10 years ago, this was devastation. Now, just look at it. Corals shaped like finely filigreed tables, like sandcastles, dozens of kinds. Many are much smaller than the corals that had been, but it's again a coral reef. The recovery looks better than I'd thought possible. Embedded in bouldery corals, small, giant clams the size of my hand pout psychedelic lips over the rims of their open shells. The color-crazed algae inside those lips turn the reef's solar power into the clam's food. Those wild lips are so sensitive that they twitch at my approaching shadow. At the wave of a hand, the shells close. I'm playing peekaboo with a clam. The fishes, angels, parrots, surgeons, rabbit fishes, sweetlips, goatfishes, triggers, wrasses, breams, blennies, and many more, clownfish, emperors, unicorn fish, different kinds of each. I recognize most groups, but the species are dizzying. This region has about 1,500 reef fish species. Why on earth so many? Can they really parse the habitat finely enough to give each kind a different job? Or do many perform redundant roles? Do the hundreds of different coral species here create such a palette of niches that only an explosion of specialists can exploit them all? Diversity in color. I have dozens of fish species in view simultaneously. Fish wearing pastels, wearing war paint, wearing spin art. Here, Pablo Picasso meets Jackson Pollock.
Carl Safina, reading from the view from Lazy Point and weaving it all together. You know, we've seen these splendors. Those lucky enough have been able to swim like you among the fish. We've all seen them. But Carl Safina takes us to another insight. He writes, I've come to see that the geometry of human progress is an expanding circle of compassion, and that nature and human dignity, never mind life, require each other. Do you see that view taking hold, Carl?
More people are becoming aware of it than ever before. But, you know, I think it's a race against time at this point, because there is a lot at stake and the trends are really dangerous. We're cutting down the forests that we need. We're using up the groundwater that we need for agriculture. You know, the Green Revolution depended as much on new ways to pump out groundwater and show people how to irrigate crops as it did on new seed varieties. And we're endangering the things that keep us human. So it's a race against time.
We'll come to your calls. Yar in Kentucky writes, we think in black and white. Seldom do we savor a sunset or sunrise, when being still and listening to our planet is the very thing the world and we need. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Adelie Penguins there on Petermann Island on the Antarctic Peninsula from a recording in 2007. Carl Safina was down Antarctic way, up to the Arctic, into the Pacific, all from his home at Lazy Point on Long Island. His new book is The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. He brought home a lot of tremendous descriptions of the wondrous nature that remains there, but also a big challenge and warning to us to adjust our thinking. He joins us today from New York. Do we still, after all we've learned, see our fate as separate from nature's? Will we change? Will we be changed? You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And I want to go to our caller, Sam, in Somerville, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air with Carl Safina.
Hey, Hey, thanks for taking my call. Great, great show. I came to the conversation a little late, so I don't know if the name has been mentioned, but I would like to invoke the name of Gregory Bateson, really one of the pioneering ecologists. He was on the forefront of cybernetics and information theory, a real polymath, a great thinker. But the point being that he was first people to really write elegantly on the subject of the mind-body duality and how he thought it really was an epistemological error of grand proportions. And I think a lot of what we're talking about today is that mistake of separating mind from body and not seeing the connectedness. And I see the trend getting much, much worse. I see it in my son. He's a very disembodied person when he's on the computer. And I would appreciate if the guests could comment on Bateson's work and how it relates to what he's doing.
Absolutely, Sam. I so appreciate your call. Of course, Bateson wrote, what, Steps to an Ecology of Mind. Carl Safina has been in reviews of this book compared to Bateson, among others. You heard him called this book called The 21st Century Walden. Carl Safina, you're very clear in saying let's not think of mind or soul as something that's just up in heaven. It lives in and it is of this earth very much as well. But there's Sam with his concern that a new generation may not be headed that way, but rather to more disembodiment, Carl.
Well, I'm unfortunately a little too aware of that bewilderment when watching our teenage children sometimes. But one of the things that I write about in the book is a larger duality that I think is mainly an illusion, and that is our simple individuality. We each think of ourselves as individuals in the world, and in some meaningful ways we are, and that's really true. But in other ways, the individual is an illusion. We depend entirely on a flow of materials through us, and so we're constantly connected to and totally relying on this flow from the world outside. Try to hold your breath for 3 minutes to make the point.
Mm-hmm.
It's been compared to the illusion of an individual has been compared to a whirlpool in a river, that the whirlpool doesn't really exist as a separate thing. It's constantly changing the water that's in it. It all of the water in the whirlpool is always different, and its existence depends entirely on the flow of water. If you stop the flow, the whirlpool isn't there anymore. And in really very real ways, that's the case for all of us. We are all a flow of matter and energy, and it makes us individuals, but the moment we unplug, we simply cease to exist.
But you write about the forms of thought that we live within that, as you say, come before a lot of these insights, at least in many cultures, religions, institutions, even philosophies. I mean, how do we make the shift? You know, those are things that happen. Those philosophical shifts often happen over centuries and centuries. We're on a planet that's changing very rapidly under our impact.
Very rapidly, yeah. And I think that the problem is we're kind of stuck with these institutions that grew up at a time when we really didn't understand the world at all. If we said, okay, let's take what we've learned in the last couple of centuries in science about the nature of the world, the nature of life, the fact that all living things are kin, the cycles, the atmospheric cycles, the water cycles, things like that. Let's take all that stuff that we know about reality, finally, to the extent that we currently understand it, and let's make an economy, a set of religions and a philosophy that recognize reality. They would look really very different. They would have the past and the future much more in mind. They would realize that our moral and ethical obligations don't just exist between individuals now, but between people now and in the future, between people and other living things, between living things and non-living things. These are the only ways that we'll be able to make this enterprise and this process succeed and continue. Otherwise, if we simply think that the whole idea is we're here to do whatever we want and to make it all bigger and bigger, then our strategy is a lot like the strategy of a cancer tumor, which is just grow, and don't think about anything else.
But how do you think of your voice as you say that? You know, you're out on your kayak, or you're up by the Arctic ice floe. You're making these tremendous observations. You're making these tremendous notions. This kind of breakthrough or revolutionary way of looking at the world, present to us right now. How do you bring that up to speed with the gigantic engines of the very kind of consumption and destruction that you're concerned about? How do you scale up to challenge them?
That's a good question. I wish I had a really great answer to that. But I do think it's a mistake for people to think I'm only one person, I have only one voice, because everyone is only one person with only one voice. And yet some people, individually and collectively, have a very large effect on moving the needle. So I'm simply trying to use the one person that I am to talk about the world as I see it.
Carl Safina writes, I hope that someday, preferably this week, the enormity of what we're risking will dawn on us. So far, it has not. Michelle writes here online, as a child, I spent my summers on Lazy Point and can completely understand how living there would move Mr. Safina to recognize the impact of our species. Lazy Point is one of those unusual places, she writes, that feels like a time capsule of 19th century style living. And New York City is only 100 miles away. The contrast, so extraordinary, it becomes a teacher. She's not the only one to notice it. Walt Whitman wrote very fondly of your neck of the woods. Elizabeth in Milton, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been thinking for quite a while about what I can do as a person, and I did come to the conclusion after seeing Mr. Safina's review in the New York Times Book Review, if we could somehow link consumerism with conservation, knowing that we all like to consume, including myself, if I could just realize where my leather shoes came from, and without our natural resources, we would have absolutely nothing to consume. If we could somehow be more aware of maybe finding a way to link the two very much more together, we might be making some progress.
But how do we do it? How do we do it when we buy those shoes in a air-conditioned mall where you know, the cow itself is far away? Elizabeth, I appreciate your call. Carl Safina, you look at Southeast Alaska as maybe an example of a region in which people are beginning to figure out the balance. What did you see there?
Yeah, well, one of the things is that this problem that we just were talking about has to do with getting our stuff in a way where we can't see where it comes from. Most of us don't know where our water comes from, where our electricity comes from, much less where our shoes come from. In Southeast Alaska, it looks like this incredible wilderness, and it's absolutely filled with eagles and salmon and bears. But there are two great things about it. One is that it's actually recovering from being very badly abused in the 20th century, in the late 1800s, where most of the salmon were fished out. Almost all the bears were going to be killed. The eagles were shot as pests. And nowadays, what we see is not just a wilderness where people have no place, but quite the opposite. We see a wild place where people fit in really beautifully, where they see where their fish are coming from. They share it with the bears and the eagles. And the reason that all of this is possible with modern people, with modern technology, is because it's scaled appropriately. There are simply not too many people there to overrun the place. And the distant markets that were taking all of the wood out at incredibly taxpayer-subsidized prices, that has been mainly ended. So the feedback loop is a little closer between people and the natural resources, and there aren't too many people to overwhelm the place. So it's been able to recover and continue to produce for people.
We're looking for models here, maybe from the kayak of Carl Safina and his travels around the world. Paul in St. Louis, Missouri is calling. Hi, Paul. Thanks. You're on the air, Paul.
Yes. Hi, Tom and Carl. You've got a very good show today. The issue of the global climate change not getting budgeted is the reason I called. And it's interesting, in listening in the last couple of minutes, you're decrying the inactivity. And it's funny, it crossed my mind that we shouldn't personalize it to the individual. Basically, the great polluters are buying Congress. And even though the greatest amount of the population is quite interested in doing something about it, they are recycling, they are attempting to buy cars that have alternative transportation, that Congress, and in fact the State of the Union this year, just last week or this week, did not budget anything toward global warming. And the idea that we the people are smart, but the leadership is being bought and sold as if they're the largest scale Judases to the planet, it's just profoundly sad.
Paul, I appreciate your call. How do we turn moral insights, vital insights, into the way of a nation, Carl?
Well, you know, I think he's put his finger right on a problem that is politically catastrophic to our country and the whole idea of our democracy. We're supposed to have one vote per person, and we're supposed to elect people who represent us. We have this money in politics, which is so corrupting. We think we don't have corruption in this country only because the corruption is all perfectly legal. The giant subsidies that are forked into these enormously profitable and yet very harmful companies that they use then to lobby to make sure that competing companies can't get scaled up, like clean energy companies. They can't get the subsidies or the scale up that would anywhere match the scale of big oil and big coal. They install the kinds of politicians by simply buying their campaigns, who will always be favorable and beholden to them. This is really catastrophic to the whole idea of America that was first envisioned. Mm. When the country was founded, corporations were basically illegal. They could only be formed for temporary specific things. Like if you want to build a bridge or a road, you can form a corporation, raise the money. When it's done, the corporation dissolves. And that has come so far away from the original idea of a free government by the people, not by rich people, not by a few people, not distorted elections. But, the biggest thing that we could do would be to eliminate all the subsidies. People who don't want big budgets and big government, they should just be in favor of cutting these subsidies.
Carl, I want to end on one of your meditations. If you'd go straight to it on 352, it may be the most valuable thing we can share. You're on the beach at Lazy Point with your dog, Kenzie. If you dive
straight in,
we've just got time to make that.
Okay. Kenzie lopes ahead toward the cut. I throw a pebble into the sound. My mind sees the ripple spreading from where a first small pebble of realization strikes until those ripples touch all shores. And in the circles rippling outward, I see a kind of geometry of compassion. Many lives are spent right where each of us first splashes in, inside that first circle. Most religions tread mainly within the perimeter of the second circle, which widens enough to encompass humanity. If we get to ride in the widest expanding circle, we call our name and hear it echo across the span of deep time, and all life answers, through the whole dance of birth and death and birth, traveling out of the past and blurring into the far future. That rippling, ever-widening circle, that's where we need to be. Albert Einstein said, "The intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant." But we have created a society that honors the servant and has forgotten the gift, unquote. Our inventiveness must serve, not enslave. Air, water, land, and skies, healing is possible. Great new innovators are plotting a course that could let factories mimic the efficiency of biological systems, cycling essentially without waste, generating renewable flows rather than liquidating nature, creating products, buildings, even cities that enter the life process itself. We can harness energy without setting fire to the world. The moral must guide the technical. Better we be threads that strengthen the fabric rather than we pull the rug from those who will come next. The mere existence of the human mind enhances the universe. Our human presence should not diminish it. And if we alone, of all creatures, can best think ahead, then we should.
Carl Safina from The View from Lazy Point. Give us a moment when nature was speaking you, reminding you of this in your year of travels in our now a bit unnatural world.
Oh, well, to me, it's always the enormous power of the migrations that I see, of all the fish and birds that come and go. And they really give me solace and delight and hope.
Carl Safina, with his new book, The View from Lazy Point. Let's hear a little bit of your long-tailed duck right here.
Yes, my favorites.
Talk about migration. Breeds in the Arctic, winters along both coasts of North America, and right there on Long Island. What's your weather today up that way, Carl?
Chilly, gray, pretty much midwinter.
The long-tailed duck goes on. This is really a beautiful book. It's really an important book. We're really grateful to you for bringing it to us. But you say unnatural world. Is it really? Is it really unnatural now? It's still out there, nature. You bring it home so beautifully.
There's plenty going on that has been happening for millions of years, but now humans are the major force, and I think we need to come to grips with what that means for all of us.
It's our time to step up. It's our responsibility. Carl Safina writes The View from Lazy Point, a natural year in an unnatural world. You can read an excerpt at our website, and we're very grateful to you for being with us today, Carl. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom. I and the long-tailed ducks of Lazy Point are very happy to be with you today.
The best to you all. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.